Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 273 of Her, the podcast where you're going to hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and today, her aging. Yeah, her very unique aging. Oh, we have such a special show coming up, and just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies that contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. Okie doke, now here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show because I absolutely thoroughly enjoy all of your feedback. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
You know, there are times when I do the podcast and I am just beyond thrilled to connect with real icons in the field of women's health and women's research. And that's what we're doing today when we're talking about all things aging and women. Our expert is Dr. Marcia Stefanik. She is a professor of medicine at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and professor of obstetrics and gynecology. She received her BA in biology from the University of Pennsylvania, her PhD in physiology at Stanford University. Dr. Stefanik is a leading pioneer in women's health research. And she's been at the forefront of the study of aging in both women and men, including the role of diet and nutritional supplements, physical activity, and body composition. Dr. Stefanik is a principal investigator of the Western Regional Center of the large Women's Health Initiative, for which she played a key leadership role in the dissemination of the landmark Women's Health Initiative hormone trials, which literally changed national recommendations regarding menopausal hormone use in older women. She championed the creation of the Stanford Center for Health Research on Women and Sex Differences in Medicine, for which she is the co-director. She has over 200 peer-reviewed publications, leadership roles within Stanford's Prevention Center, Cardiovascular and Cancer Institutes, and School of Medicine. I'm exhausted just reading your bio, Dr. Stefanik, but I'll just take a huge breather here. But I have to tell everyone out there in the Her podcast land, my incredible wide female audience, that we, Dr. Stefanik and I, share some very special friends in common, including Dr. Vivian Pinn, who was the first director of the Office of Women's Research at the National Institutes of Health. And I met her while I was a senior research fellow there in the Institute of Child Health Human Development. And we became very, very close friends. And I just enjoyed every moment with her, only to find out that clearly Dr. Stefanik worked with her in lockstep as this entire Women's Health Initiative was unfolding over the course of time. So, Dr. Stefanik, welcome so much to the Her podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So, listen, I'm reading the Wall Street Journal, and there is this absolutely fascinating article that just came out. It was actually July 14th, 2020, called Women and Men Age Differently in More Ways Than Just Longevity. Researchers find important gender-based distinctions in how aging affects cardiovascular health, immunity, and the brain. So I'm sort of buzzing along here reading this, and life expectancy for women is expected to reach 87.3 years and for men 83.9 years by 2060, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. And I'm buzzing along reading, and then I come along to read your comment. And that is, you know, that whole issue of men and women age differently. They do. Women have long been left out of aging-related studies, you said. So researchers are playing a game of catch-up. And there's so many social, cultural, and economic factors that set women and men apart as they age. Talk to us about that. What comes to mind?
Well, first of all, I'll just correct one thing you said, and that is I'm the founding director of the Women's Health and Sex Differences in Medicine Center, called the Wisdom Center. So it abbreviates to Wisdom. And so sex differences is one of my passions. And so when we talk about women's health, you know, I think people don't realize that 52% of women make it to age 80, and only 35% of men do in this country. So when we start to talk about, you know, this new age of 80 plus, we're talking about women who are making it well into their 90s. So when you say, you know, the life expectancy is 87, I think you said, by 2060.
Yes.
You know, it's a case where there are a lot more older women than there are older men. And older women have a lot of social responsibilities. They're still, you know, men are grandfathers too, but grandmothers, you know, have a little bit more active role. Women often are the caregivers for their spouses. So there's a lot of responsibilities that older women have that probably plays into why they age a little differently. There's a lot of biology. There's a lot of sociocultural roles, that we call that gender, that play into this difference between men and women. And I will say I do also a lot of work with the LGBTQ plus world. So I do think about non-binary persons a lot who are really left out of the literature. So I just want to make that quick point.
Yeah. And when did you actually start delving into the sex differences and trying to wrap your head around that? Was that something that was recent?
Well, it doesn't seem recent anymore. So I'll actually say that it first emerged in 2001. So that's definitely not recent. And that was when the Institute of Medicine, which is now the National Academy of Science, released a really important book, a project that they had been doing called Sex Matters. And it was really looking at, are there differences? Does sex matter in biology? Does it matter in medicine? And the answer was yes. In fact, the answer was, you know, every cell has sex. So when we start to do basic science, almost no cell biologists know the sex of their cell, and they should, because a cell that has an XX chromosome versus an XY chromosome functions quite differently. And so that came out in 2001, and then slowly, the Office of Research on Women's Health, which is what Vivian Pinn really was the founding director of that, started to really embrace this, the idea of sex differences. And the current director, Janine Clayton, wrote with Frances Collins in 2015. They released, well, 2014, they first brought this out, that we really need to be looking at sex as a biological variable, and no one should be doing research without looking at how males and females differ. Again, trying to get the non-binary in there as well. But the point being is that it's been happening through most of my more, you know, the last two decades. And in terms of the Wisdom Center, which is the Women's Health and Sex Differences in Medicine, that was launched in 2013, but we had already been doing symposia on sex differences as well as women's health symposia for, you know, several years before that. So I would say at least 10 years, it's been a pretty active part of my life.
Wow. And thank you for doing that, though. It's about time we really had an opportunity to address issues that have literally just been not even sidebarred, they've just been covered. Nobody really wanted to even acknowledge their existence. If you could do me a favor, I know that several of my team members were so excited you were going to be on because one of them is actually still a participant in the Women's Health Initiative. They're still getting interviewed about their life. It's been many, many years as they've been collecting data, et cetera. How much has the Women's Health Initiative really been a game changer in women's lives as they've looked at this journey with changes in hormones over the course of the perimenopause and menopause?
Well, I think the Women's Health Initiative really is the most important study of older women that's ever been done. So the women's, we started way back in 1993 to 98. We recruited 167,000 women into trials. We had a hormone trial, menopausal hormone trial, which I'll mention in a minute. We had a big diet study. So women were changing their diet to a lower fat, higher fruits and vegetable diet for cancer prevention. And we had calcium and vitamin D supplementation trial. And these were all huge trials, looking for hard endpoints, looking for heart disease and breast cancer and colon cancer and hip fractures. That takes big numbers and a lot of time, and an observational study. So we did all of that. The hormone trial was kind of the shock heard around the world when in 2002, we reported that the combination of estrogen and progestin as a menopausal hormone treatment or therapy, I don't know that I want to say treatment, but that the risks outweighed the benefits. And so that was a huge shocker because physicians up to that time were encouraging women to go on these hormones to prevent heart disease. We were always worried about breast cancer. We always, you know, recognized its potential benefit to bone, but we needed to do this trial. So 2002 is when the combination trial came out. And basically said that, you know, showed that estrogen and progestin combined, which is what a woman with a uterus would take to prevent her uterus from getting endometrial cancer from the estrogen, that they had more strokes. At the initial publication, there were more heart attacks that kind of modified to just a neutral where it was no benefit to heart disease at all. And they had more blood clots, especially in their lungs and their legs. And they had more breast cancer. So that was the scariest part. And that has actually continued. So women who had gone on those hormones in the trial are still showing more breast cancers emerging. So the long-term impact of taking the combination is clearly, you know, a concern. So we do recommend that for women who have a uterus that they consider this really for severe menopausal symptoms, still indicated for that, but short term, lowest dose possible. And then 2 years later, we released the estrogen only results, which were more neutral. It did increase stroke, but it did not increase breast cancer, no benefit to heart disease. There was some discussion about younger women, so women who are closer to menopausal age seemed to have more benefits, and it was really the older women going on those hormones that had the worst outcomes. So that really changed the way physicians prescribe menopausal hormones. That pretty much we talk a lot more about lifestyle approaches, yoga, you know, things that can help you with your sleep, and, you know, other forms. And again, short-term, low-dose hormones if you really have severe symptoms. We also did these other trials, but if I can just jump ahead and say we've continued to...
Oh, please do.
We've continued to follow the women for a long time. Lots of publications have come out. So the literature is full of Women's Health Initiative publications from the trials, the diet trial, the hormone trial, the calcium trial, and from the observational study. But then in 2010, we reconsented the women who were interested into an extension study. So the Women's Health Initiative extension study, which is continuing to this day. And in fact, we are all now negotiating with the NIH on the contract to continue it through 2027. So it will go on for another 5 to 7 years. And what we've done in that is, you know, continue to find new science, to look for a lot of genetic factors, to look at ancestry, you know, kind of distinguishing race ethnicity from ancestry, trying to dig more into the race ethnic issues that are so important, especially now. You know, we're realizing that we just have a dearth of information on women in you know, of color. And so we do have a multi-ethnic cohort, which Vivian Pinn, by the way, played a huge role in ensuring that.
Oh, yes, she did. Oh, she did. Well, people should also understand, you know, we talk about Vivian like our best friend, which she was. But people need to understand she was a leader in so many ways. But she was also the first Black physician actually be in her medical school class at University of Virginia. She was oftentimes the only woman, let alone the only Black woman in the room in her leadership roles. And so she had a real sense of the importance of making sure to honor the issue of diversity. And she still does to this day, even though she's emeritus now from the NIH, she still speaks and she's still out there messaging. And I'm thrilled. I remember I sent you a link of one of her latest events. And so I'm so glad you brought that up. That is very, very important. You know, you shared with me a wonderful article, and this was by Victor Fuchs and Mark Cullen et al. And it was called "The Weaker Sex, Vulnerable Men and Women's Resilience in Socioeconomic Disadvantage." And I found this to be exquisitely compelling, this entire topic, as we're talking about women and differences in aging, because the aging process requires resilience, you know, the sort of what I love to call a keen grasp of the obvious. And here we're looking at it with regard to socioeconomic disadvantage. I was wondering if you could kind of just sort of give us a capsule summary of what that was about.
Yeah, so I'll actually start from their original question was about geographic variability for premature mortality. Mm-hmm. And so they did this amazing analysis of every county in the United States to look at, they were really interested in race-ethnic differences in terms of premature mortality. And what emerged from that analysis was, yes, a huge difference between Blacks and whites in the country, but even stronger difference between men and women. And so that difference held up whether you talked about white women versus white men, Black women versus Black men. It actually looked like for mortality and actually survival to age 70 is what they focused on as their metric.
Yes.
And they showed that Black women and white men are pretty similar in the likelihood of surviving to age 70. Whereas white women were far on the one side of much more likely to make it to age 70 and beyond, as I mentioned, 52% make it to 80, and that Black men were much less likely. So a very clear, like Black men are at a huge disadvantage relative to white men, but also particularly relative to white women. So whenever I talk about sex differences, I do what we, you know, I focus on intersectional components. So, you know, everything differs by age. So a lot of things that people say men are like this and women are like that, it's like, well, it depends on what age you're talking about. Or men are like this and women are like that. Well, it depends on what race ethnicity you're talking about. And then when you, you know, start putting those, all those pieces together, you get quite a diverse set of binary assumptions. So everything ends up still trying to be men versus women, but it's like, it's just not that simple. But in this analysis that Mark Cullen and colleagues did with Victor Fuchs, they were really teasing apart socioeconomic factors or sociocultural factors like poverty, income, education, occupation. And what they showed is that across every one of these scales, so if you went from being rich woman to a poor woman, rich man to a poor man, you see that the women are pretty resilient. They hold up pretty well, even if they're poor, relative to poor men. That poor men do much worse than rich men, and poor women don't do as bad as, you know, compared to rich women. And that's also true for income, that the higher your income, the closer men and women are. So as men become rich, then they look pretty much like a rich woman in terms of mortality. But if they are poor, they do much worse than a poor woman. And then also education, the more education that a man has, the closer he looks to women. So you narrow the gap. There's always the gap is still there. Like, you know, with levels of education, women still do better than men with an equal level of education. But men who have less education do much worse than men with more education relative to women. And then also with occupations, you know, similar, they have these special indices. So it's just that whatever the variable is, women just seem to be able to, you know, be more resilient, and men seem to be much more vulnerable. And, you know, they, in this paper, they show how this is true really across the world. So they've done lots of different time, historic time frames, so that you have certain periods of our time that are particularly stressful, like the one we're going through now. And men do worse than women do. And in fact, with COVID, I think you're probably quite aware that, you know, men are dying. Men and women are getting the infection at a similar rate, but men are dying at a higher rate. So about 60% of deaths are men relative to women. Even when you age match that, you know, a lot of people want to say it's about hormones. They always want to make everything about hormones. But this is in a group that are postmenopausal, so there's not very much estrogen on board anymore, and they still are much more resilient than men are.
I think part of that is, you know, they were looking at the XX factor versus the XY, and the fact that immunologic factors tend to be highly associated with X and the X chromosome. And what they find is that, you know, we've got women have a double hit of the X and men don't. And they think that there might be a little something going on with that. At the same time, I really do think that there's a very strong issue of resilience from multiple platforms, you know, mentally, physically, and otherwise. Women tend to also try to be much more attentive to their own self-care as best they can within their own limitations and constraints, because they are caregivers. Ironically, many times they take good care of themselves so they could take good care of other people around them. They know that they have to really be able to do that. They are caregivers to their partners, to whomever, you know, their family members, this and that. And a lot of that gives them meaning and purpose, which allows them, again, mentally, physically, to be a lot more resilient, I think. And I think this is borne out by some fairly credible literature as well. But it is interesting. Have you looked at centenarians? You know, the differences,
well,
you know.
Yeah, we're getting more and more of them. You know, like I actually tell my students now at Stanford that, you know, probably half of them will get to 100, you know, which wasn't so true of my age group, or certainly of my mom's. But so I haven't really studied that. We've done a lot with 80 plus. So we've done a lot of work in the WHI with, we have a big, you know, pretty sizable cohort of women who are 80 and over. And by the way, I will tell you that, you know, people always want to make it 65 plus. That just doesn't work anymore, because we are living so much longer that, you know, when you say 65 plus, that includes your centenarians and your 90s and your 80s. And more of the literature now are dividing things into, you know, 65 to 79 or 65 to 84, and 85 plus is now the new, you know, the oldest of the old. And so we're going to be having lots more of men and women. So men, I also have a huge study of older men the study of osteoporotic fractures in men. And those men were 65 and over when we started back in 2000 to 2002. So the youngest man is now 83 and the mean age is 92. And we have several centenarians in that group as well. So we know that men are doing better all the time, but we still have, you know, many more older women.
Yeah, I think that that COVID issue with defining people who are 65 and older as it were elderly, needless to say, the boomers were not enjoying that. And I actually had on my podcast one of the regular writers for the Wall Street Journal, who wrote a fabulous piece called "Who Are You Calling Elderly?" And she herself, I know, seriously, and she herself is like about 65, and she, like me, we're both triathletes. I'm actually on the board of the Senior Olympics, and I'm a competing Senior Olympic triathlete. You know, I'll be damned if someone's calling my, you know, myself, you know, elderly, as it were, because it just, it's such an old stereotype. Versus I really see now, and I agree with you, that there are different silos now, different sectors after the age of 50, you know, where you bundle them differently. And I think we're aging differently. And I would say there's a good solid sector of those boomers who really have taken on the aging process very differently. And I'm not talking about a bunch of wealthy, you know, Manhattanites who can afford, you know, very expensive training. I'm talking about people just paying a heck of a lot more attention. And they've read the literature. And so there's a really cool study I got wind of a while back, and I'm sure you know about it. It's the Healthy Aging Welderly study from researchers at the Scripps Research Translational Institute. And when they launched this, this was basically, I love this, this was a study where you had to be at least 80. I love that. And they have people from 80 to 105. And here's the only, here's your ticket in. You cannot have developed any common chronic medical condition or disease. Now, they're not calling like arthritis, you know, which is just basically wear and tear, you know, part of that medical condition or disease. They're talking about things like big time diabetes and heart disease and all the rest of it. And interestingly, they have these fascinating people, and some of the centenarians fall in here too, who just haven't had any issues other than, you know, a little wear and tear, and they just sort of kind of made it there. And they're studying them very closely, both genetically and otherwise, very much like the guys at Harvard with, you know, the centenarians. And I just, I find it to be quite fascinating looking at the resilience and what it takes to be able to live to that age and to thrive in a big way. But you're looking at that too, aren't you?
Oh, yes. So, you know, the Women's Health Initiative now is very much a study of aging, as is the Mr. Os study, which is the study of the osteoporotic fracture study. So we are definitely studying aging and muscle loss. So, you know, as a triathlete, you would care about that. I was a marathoner and I still run. And, you know, the issue is that as you age, you slowly lose muscle. A lot of things that we call aging, we really need to figure out, well, is it because you just stopped doing it and therefore you're losing muscle? If you kept doing it, would you retain the muscle? Doesn't look like you can hold on to everything, that aging is clearly there, but there's a lot we can do. And, you know, when you were talking about women being more resilient, there are places where women don't do as well as men. So, for instance, smokers, women who smoke are much more likely to get a heart attack than a man who smokes. Women who smoke are more likely to get lung cancer than a man who smokes. So there's a whole bunch of places where, you know, a really bad lifestyle makes you, you know, you lose that, whatever that protective factor might be, it, you know, you lose it. And so, and physical activity, we're doing a big study, a physical activity study now within the WHI called WISH. So it's the Women's Health Initiative Strong and Healthy Study. And our women are, you know, they were 68 to 99 when we started. Now they're 73 to 100 and something. I don't know how many centenarians we have. But, you know, just trying to take each woman at her current level of physical function and her current level of activity and just get her to move more and sit less. So sitting is probably the most destructive behavior we have, that, you know, just getting up, standing up and moving around is really important. So just sitting is different. So even if you did your 30 minutes a day of exercise, if you sat the rest of the day, you don't do as well as someone who, you know, isn't sitting all the rest of the day. And so that's something we need to get more and more people to realize, is that just sitting is bad for us. And older people tend to sit a lot more. So, you know, a goal is to age better. We need to stop sitting and we need to be walking, which I think is another, it's the silver lining of COVID for those of us who aren't essential workers. Obviously for essential workers, they go to work, but, you know, I think more and more people are walking. You know, I'm seeing that. I'm seeing all age groups, so it's not just older people walking. But.
Well, I'm laughing when you're saying that. I'm sorry, I'm just sitting back. I'm on the board of trustees of the American College of Sports Medicine. I'm a fellow of the college. And as such, you can only imagine that we've been yelling and screaming, ranting and raving for God knows how long. We're please, please, let's get more active, et cetera, et cetera. And then along comes COVID. And next thing you know, you see all these people outdoors walking and, you know, hand in hand, you know, obviously if it's like a couple or if it's a family or back and forth. And you never saw that before. And then you ask them what's going on and they're reading headlines saying, number one, literally the safest place to be is outdoors, especially on a nice humid day. In terms of just spread of the disease, so long as you're obviously physical distancing appropriately. And it'll also help you with lung function because you want to make sure to have very strong lung muscles or pulmonary muscles. So that's, you know, your chest and all the rest. Take deep breaths, especially through the nose, et cetera, et cetera. So they're just doing all these great things to remain healthy. And to your point, a woman, well, men and women both experience a change in body composition as they get older. By the seventh decade of life, everyone has something we call sarcopenia, which is the beginning of loss of some muscle mass, actually.
Well, I'll just jump in and say that we know that that starts when you're in your 40s.
So oh, yes.
It doesn't really show up in a big, serious way. But and you probably know the different kinds of muscle. You have the fast twitch and the slow twitch. So the fast twitch are the first to go. So that's why you slow down. But that's why we probably need to be doing a little more power work, a little bit more hills, a little bit more speed
intensity.
Work.
Intensity.
Yep. Yep.
This is why high intensity interval training, it's all relative to the individual, you know, is so incredibly important. At the American College of Sports Medicine, you know, we've developed white papers and we're the ones who are the senior investigators on the grand majority of the national guidelines, et cetera. And one of the things we've discovered is really quite fascinating. And to your point, by the age of 40, you must be incorporating and integrating more strength training. So many women, especially, not so much men, but so many women, you know, of certain generations, of older generations, were never even told how important it is to have strength training, both for bone health, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really important because if you don't use it, you lose it. And one of the most powerful, you know, points I ever heard from Dr. Butler when he was doing his thing with the Aging Institute was the fact that so many of the symptoms of what we thought were aging were the symptoms of disuse.
Yep, that's my point. Yeah.
We
need to do so. This big physical activity trial, so it's a trial, it's a randomized trial with NWHI, is really trying to see if we get older women. So again, they were 68 when they started, but now they're, you know, the youngest is 73 and they're up in their hunts. But if you can get them to move more and sit less, you know, do we actually see that they have longer independence? Do they, you know, do get less heart disease? That's the main question, but also less cancer. Do they, you know, does it help their dementia? Does it help, you know, prevent dementia? So all of these are important questions that, you know, we have enough data to say we expect it to be true. It's just hard to do these randomized studies.
Oh, God, listen, been
and
there, done that.
This is a huge study. This is like 49,000 women. You know,
oh, my goodness gracious.
So it's a big study that will, you know, we won't, it won't be coming out for a couple of years, but it's
you
a
know,
really important study.
And I've oftentimes talked to, you know, our mutual colleague, Dr. Joanne Manson over at Harvard, as she's been very interested in physical activity as well, but in this case using the nurses study. What is their cohort? 60,000 now? I think it is ish, something
yeah,
like that.
I'm not sure how many, because they add new women. They keep adding as well as, you know, just retaining. So they,
yeah, it's a prospective.
The number changes
yeah.
up and down. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the good news is, guess what? Here's what makes me happy. What makes me happy is the fact that we're getting more and more information. That's what's happening. And, you know, when Vivian came on board, we had the first woman who ever headed the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Bernadine Healy. And I remember specifically sitting up in my lab and in the clinical center when word came across that when Healy came on board, one of the first things she said was that if there is a trial that we at the NIH are going to fund, if it is appropriate that women are included. Obviously, things like prostate cancer are not appropriate because it's irrelevant. But if it's something else, heart disease, you know, diabetes, whatever, and if women are not included, they will not be funded. And you will have to show justification as to why you will not include them. So you better have a damn good reason. So it was the first time, I mean, my jaw hit the floor and I said, wow. You know, how crazy is it?
That really is a mandate now. So again, Janine Clayton from the current Office of Research on Women's Health and Frances Collin have made that a NIH policy that sex is a biological variable, you know, must be considered. You have to really have good justification why you don't have both men and women in a trial of any time. And the other group that really needs to be studied are older people. So I went to a workshop at the NIH 2 years ago called Lifespan, and it was looking at the fact that, you know, the pediatric studies generally had a lot of people in their 18s who they were still barely, you know, still children, but they didn't have as many studies of younger kids as they thought they needed. But when it came to the National Institute of Aging and all the institutes that include older people in their trials, they had very little data on 75 and over. So, you know, the young seniors, which is the 65 to 74 group now, and that's kind of what they're called, you know, there are some good studies there, particularly for men, not so many for women. But when it comes to 75 and over, which a really high percent of the population is going to be there, we have very little data. We have very little data on how drugs work in older people, and they're the main people using them. You know, so there's a whole bunch of things. And I will also quickly say, since this is really focusing on women, you know, almost all the drugs that we have out on the market were studied in men and not in women. And we
have
one drug that has male and female dosing, and that's Zolpidem, which is, you know, basically a sleep drug that many more women take than men. And it was the first drug that the FDA, and this was back in 2013, said we really have to have two doses because women were crashing. They were having, like, they would take this sleep medication, and it's called Ambien is the way that most people would refer
to
it.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, they saw that women were not clearing it from their system in the 8 hours. And when they'd get up to go to work, they were having a huge percent, like 15% were having serious driving accidents. And so they came out with two doses, but that's the only drug. So we have all of these drugs where we know that women's body composition is different from men, including, and of course, older people is different from younger people. So when we talk about our entire medical approach, we have not taken into account either aging or women in most of the medications that we have. So since we're focusing on older women should be aware, that, you know, we don't have good research to back up a lot of the treatments that they're taking. So they better take care of themselves. They better go out there and walk and not smoke if they could help it.
Well, you know, you remember the famous nun study, the University of Kentucky group. And by the grace of heaven, you know, I'm in Bethesda. I can see the NIH. You know, it's very interesting. I had the incredible opportunity of meeting one of the more famous of the nuns, Sister Genevieve Kunkel. And she was, this was the nuns of the Notre Dame. And the big convent is in Baltimore. And so I got a chance to go over there, meet her. At some of the best pictures you'll ever see. She comes up to about my hip, you know, because I'm tall. And absolutely extraordinary, you know, women. Now it helps. The big joke among the nuns is it helps they were never married. We're not going to even bring that one up, Dr. Stefanik. That's just, that's a completely different, you know, podcast entirely. We're just going to let that one blow. But I remember when I spoke to Sister Kunkel, I said, you know, she was asked on the Today Show because she was always used for PR. She was so articulate. She just finished her second master's degree at the age of 90, just a trip and a half. You know, she said in response to the question, so what's the secret of your success for longevity? She passed away about the age of 106, I think it was. And I met her in her later 90s, and she was just as, you know, fresh as the day is long. She's just amazing. So she said, always said the same thing, and I use it as my motto. So she goes, well, I have but two good traits. And I said, well, what are they? She says, well, I'm alert and I'm vertical. And that was it. So the alert clearly speaks to, you know, staying mentally on top of it. And vertical means, you know, you're standing up, honey. You know, you're vertical. You're not horizontal. And that was her way of just saying, I remember when I had my picture taken with her, because I just had to have this picture just for myself. It was so precious. I'll send it to you sometime. And she was using a little cane. And she said, No, I have to put the cane away. Nothing. No one shall see that I have a cane. And then she came hobbling over to my side. She just wanted to show everyone that she was strong, you know, and that's the kind of attitude all the way around. And then we were done with the photo shoot and she grabbed her little cane, just kept it going. Just, I can't make this stuff up. Alert and vertical. And I'll always remember that as sort of a motto for my own aging process. Just kind of, oh, and there was one last thing that I want to bring up. The nuns just loved this one thing. The really successful ones who, you know, really, I mean, the grand majority have made it into, you know, significant older age without dementia. Some, of course, became demented, but mass majority did not. And they prided themselves on having the skinniest little medical records. Like there's nothing in there. There's just, you know, there's no like monster chronic illness or, you know, something came up and it was like, you know, volume 3 of their medical record. It was just little records, fairly straightforward, check-ins, some prevention and back and forth. And they always laughed about that. They said, well, you know, that's just kind of the way they roll. And I just love it. It was, what was it called? Aging Gracefully was the name of the textbook, if you remember. And it was worth a read. Just a beautiful piece about the nuns. I just, oh, you know something, Dr. Stefanik, you and I can talk forever about this stuff. I so thoroughly enjoy listening to you, your incredible work, your dedication, your clear passion and compassion, you know, for this entire sector. And on behalf of everyone here at the HER podcast and my entire audience, all I can say is thank you for all that you do to help advance science, you know, and to be able to help women of all ages be able to optimize their own aging process and to understand what's happening with their bodies. So thank you. We're very grateful for that.
Well, and I'm just going to say, I hope that all of your listeners realize that across the entire age spectrum, moving more and sitting less is good. You know, trying to do all the lifestyle things we've heard about, the right kind of diet, not smoking, that's what's really going to be more important than all this medical stuff that we do. Really, we have the power within ourselves to keep ourselves, you know, independent and fully functional. So that's a plea for everybody, because I think you'll feel a lot better too.
Oh, there's no question about it. Dr. Stefanik, I can't thank you enough for being on the HER podcast. Everyone out there in the HER podcast land, we've been talking to Dr. Marcia Stefanik. She's a professor of medicine at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and professor of obstetrics and gynecology. She has championed the creation of the Stanford Center for Health Research on Women and Sex Differences in Medicine. And the acronym for that is WISDOM, which I absolutely love. And she is probably one of the top pioneers and leading pioneers in women's health research, and has been at the forefront of the study of aging in both women and men. Dr. Stefanik, thank you for being on the HER podcast.
Real pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And everyone out there, please take a minute to hit iTunes and rate and review the show, because the feedback from this show, oh, I cannot wait to hear from you. Why? Well, because I'm Dr. Pam Peek. I'm host of the HER podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every episode of the HER podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe and stay well.